The Tea Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop In.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Tea Stop In. Ben Allen here with you. And today I'm speaking with the extraordinary Martin Rue, ASC. Martin, welcome to the Tea Stop In.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Now, you've had a really extraordinary career, both in Germany and now in Hollywood as well.
Well, thank you very much.
But I really want to have a chat with you about an extraordinarily beautiful film from a couple of years back, a film called The Midnight Sky.
Thank you very much. Glad you liked it.
Now, this was an amazing project with George Clooney directing and produced for Netflix. How did you come to be involved in the film?
I started working with George Clooney a couple of years ago on Catch 22, and that worked out really well. We got on very well together. The result was nice. And then he decided to keep on working together and offered me The Midnight Sky.
And what were your early conversations about the project?
Well, early on, George said, you know, it's a little bit like The Revenant and Gravity in one film, because it's survival on Earth in very harsh and cold conditions. And it's a space movie as well. Yet it's very intimate and small in a sense. So we talked about it. You know, he wanted it not to be like Gravity, not to be like any other space movie. So we started talking pretty early on, and his instincts were to do things different, and I was all up for that challenge.
And with the look of the film, you can definitely see those influences of The Revenant and Gravity there, but then it just takes those as a jumping off point and really builds on those with its own unique look.
I think it's, you know, those films are there and you are influenced by them. And you know, but for example, I think just the opening shot of Gravity, they took a year to get that done. And we never had that time anyways. And we didn't want to copy anything of that. We also had post-production people who worked on Gravity. So there's a lot of knowledge from Gravity. George was obviously. There's a lot of knowledge from Gravity, which made it into our into the techniques we used. But then we tried to be different in a way, you know.
One of the things that struck me watching the film is it feels like George must be a real student of cinema.
He's done it for so long. He worked with some of the best directors around and for over 30 years he's been in front of the camera. So I think he watched very well what's around and he still looks at every film there is. And when we started talking, you know, he brought up one film like On the Beach, which we have a little clip in our film by Stanley Kramer. And he liked the staging of that and the mood of that. And that, again, is a strange film because it's slow, it's simple, but the theme they're talking about is almost the end of the world, similar to us. And they did it in a nice and decent way. So we watched that for a little bit of our staging, for the pace of things. We watched some space movies. We watched Revenant, but you know, that was, I think that's less relevant for us. And then we took those things on board. So yes, there's influences, yet we tried to make it our own.
And how did that collaboration work through the process of then making the film?
There's certain areas where we knew exactly what we wanted. There's certain areas where we did previous, you know, that spacewalk or the scene where Maya dies, when Augustine and Iris are in that pot and it sings at night. Those were scenes we had previous with our visual effects department. So we knew then when we started shooting, oh, this shot needs that, this shot needs this from stunts or this from visual effects. We can shoot this on stage. We can shoot this in a studio. We want to shoot this for real. And, you know, this is a full CGI shot. And all of that we knew pretty well. And then there's a lot of other scenes which are smaller and more intimate, which we try to figure out after rehearsals and give, you know, George was acting in a lot of those scenes with the little girl with no dialogue. So I wanted to give them space and we had the room ready. And then we decided, oh, we want to go here or there with the camera and we could do that very quickly.
How important do you find that is, giving the actors and the director space to do what they need to do?
I think you have to balance, you know, there are certain things you need to do and you need to get right. And otherwise they don't work. So there you need precision and everybody will understand that. But I tend to not tell actors, look this way and then the light is just perfect in this moment. I rather have them feel free in a space and don't think about that. And also my films, very often they didn't have much time. So and those things take time. And I'd rather, you know, have a good energy, a good flow. So the director gets to work as long as he needs to with the actors. And then, you know, you're part of it. It's one flow. And sometimes you see films, they are the most beautiful things and the most elaborate, perfectly lit things. But then, you know, they don't touch you.
When I was talking to John Seal, he spoke about nobody cares if you take beautiful pictures of a film that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. But there's many examples of that. And I never tried, always tried to not do that. Simple in the approach. And then, you know, don't get people busy thinking about technology and that can be the case.
So in a practical sense, while you're shooting or planning the shoot, how do you go about doing that?
Well, in this, like in the spaceship, I tried to build in as much light as possible into the spaceship. So we had miles and miles of LED. They were all RGBW, so we could change the color everywhere we wanted. We were very flexible. And then we just brought in Astera tubes, and then my gaffer had put them in little triangles so we could just put them on the floor and slide them in here and there. Sometimes a sky panel, but very little, very simple. And the other part was then switch off lights. And then, you know, very quickly you get to a place where you can do something. Also, the spaceship had very small contained areas and was built in a way that taking out a wall would be very long. So we did it once, I think. And then for the spacewalk, it was very simple because they are traveling back from Jupiter to Earth. So the direction the ship is heading should be always towards the sun. So we had one single light source, which we bounce around a couple of times. And the other main stuff is just some sky panels through diffusion, which we had on wheel to get it in there and stuff. But we tried to keep it very simple.
So that spacewalk sequence, how much of that was CGI?
For that one, we had a virtual model and we were basically working a couple of months on a previs for that. We started in September, we started doing our first previs and that was new to me, but we had a model of the ship on a computer. Then, you know, you might have done that, but for me it was new. We went to a meeting room, they put tape marks on the floor and they said, this is the beginning of the ship, this is the end of the ship. If we work at this scale, at a one-to-one scale, and then we would I tried the goggles, that made me feel weird, and then you had controls.
Yeah.
But then I took an iPad and told them, this will be not a hand-held shot, but I want this move and I want this. We went through all the shots. Then later we decided, okay, the big wide shot when the spaceship is hit, that's fully CGI. This, when we have the two people in the foreground, one people in the background, these are real. This is CGI. And then so that's how we then worked it out. But basically what was nice about it is that we were able to, you know, between me, George, the visual effects department, and also the production design, you know, the construction and the stunts. They were all so well informed that we need this, we need to build this for real, we need to, this has to be a model, this has to be able to do this, and the wires have to be, you know, moving people from here to there, and we knew that pretty well. And Stephen Marioni edited this. It was not a previs which was done out of house. It was basically George's and my vision.
So it sounds like it was a very efficient production.
Oh yeah, it was very efficient. And the nice thing to work with George is that he surrounds himself with people he trusts, and obviously the work has to be good. But so there's a familiarity within that. So yeah. You know, I'd done visual effects with Matt Kastner on Catch 22. Mm-hmm. You know, Jim has done 6 or 7 films with George. Everybody's there for a long time, and that makes it, there's a level of trust there, which is really great.
To watch, though, it feels like an epic film. I mean, it's just breathtakingly big.
happy to hear that. Now, that was the beauty of it. I think the beauty of it is that it's so big, and that the space people are in has to feel so big because they're so lost, and it makes it, you know, makes you feel more for them when they try to communicate with each other and can't. And to feel the isolation. We shot it on 65. That was something we decided early on.
And what was the rationale behind choosing the Alexa 65?
I wanted to have 65 for the big vistas, for the big wide shots, to get all the detail in there. In the beginning, we also talked about our movie becoming that there would be an IMAX print. Mm-hmm. But due to COVID, that never happened. It was released in some cinemas, but we always treated it as a cinema movie. And that was always the plan. Now, it has been in some cinemas, but not that many.
I was actually very lucky that it was screening in the cinemas here in Sydney. And so I got to see it on the big screen, and it definitely looks very at home there on a cinema screen.
That was always the ambition.
Mm. As well as the 65 format, what other elements did that inform?
65 was one thing. And what we realized, what I wasn't that aware of, that 65 is great for the big vistas, but it's also very beautiful for faces.
Yeah.
Because, you know, fall off is so nice, and then yet what you see in focus makes the face almost like a landscape. It's so beautiful. It forces you to get close with a camera, because if you put 100 on a 65, it starts looking like any other 100, but you end up going with a 65 or 55 closer, and it's a beautiful effect. We looked at the lenses, 65 lens. The lenses are like the DNA lenses, Iris DNA lenses, because we detuned them a little bit to our liking. We didn't want it to be too perfectly sharp.
So what aspects were you looking at in the detuning of those lenses? Because as I understand it, there's quite a lot of flexibility with how they can modify those lenses, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And you test a little bit, and certain also all the lenses react slightly different to the detuning. On some, it adds a lot of beauty. On some, it adds a little bit of confusion. Yeah. We tested it and figured it out. And they just get a little bit softer, a little bit more character. The fall off to the edges becomes nice and just feels a little bit less perfect. Mm. You know, like the Hasselblads were so sharp everywhere. And also, you know, you have to shoot an f-stop of 4 or 5, 6, and that, I don't like that. So the DNA felt like a natural choice. There's one other lens we used quite a bit, which they call 58T at Arri. And that's a lens which only, you know, only this much of the center of frame is really in focus and the rest falls off. Wow. We used that a few times when we wanted to be with the actors in their heads. So when Augustine does his first blood transfusion in the beginning, we wanted to be with him in his head. And when he thinks of the, you know, of the past and then looks at the sky, we wanted to fade everything out. We use it when Sally is sad about Maya's death, or when Maya realizes when she's in space, there's only one shot where we use it. And when she's in space and she goes back after the thing happens and the droplet of blood, she realizes that's the moment we have this lens. And then
wow.
you everything else fades away a little bit.
That's amazing. It seems to me that we're kind of, and I've had this conversation with a number of people recently, that we seem to be in, I think, a golden age of lens choices.
I would agree, but that's also because it's because we're working so much electronically now. The chips become so, in a way, they're kind of code because they just register.
Yep.
And the film would add before. The film had its own character. The chip doesn't have that, whatever camera it is.
So we're looking for that more and more from the lenses.
I think so. I think that's what you want. You want to add a little more into it. You want to give it your choice, you know.
Yeah.
And then some lenses do that by just, you know, I don't know. Have you ever had that when you think, oh, this is so beautifully shot, and how did they ever do that? And then you get those lenses, whatever, Panavision C-Series, yeah, yeah, you put on, say, that's so simple. That's how it is. Yes, you can.
Yeah. It can add so much.
And it can also be so bad because, you know, sometimes if you do it or if you see a film, some films don't age well.
Mm.
They owe too much in one word or, you know, trying too hard.
How did the VFX team feel about the detuning of the DNA lenses? Did that affect them?
Well, we were scared a little bit about it, but they were embracing it. They were very much game. And they, you know, we did tests early on. We gave them lens grids. We gave them all the information. They were like, oh, yeah, we can pull that off. We can do that in any way you want. So we're like, oh, wow, really? And you're not scared of this or that? And they're no, because it adds just realism to it, and it adds flavor to it. And it's not like, oh no, this sequence feels different because we have to do this for technical reasons.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of differences, where you wanted differences, the different looks within the film, you know, in the spaceship, you know, in the buildings, and then out in the wild of the Arctic. What philosophy and technical aspects did you bring to that?
A lot of the different looks comes from the production design. So we spoke to Jim, and I spoke a lot with George about the different worlds and how it would be here, how it would be there. We tested a little bit in colors on the spaceship. When we started shooting, the spaceship wasn't there, basically. We started shooting in Iceland.
Yeah.
Then we came back and we shot in the Babo, the Arctic station, in Shepparton on stage. And they were constantly, you know, the spaceship was being built, the set pieces of the spaceship. So we were constantly going back and forth and looking at things and trying this light, that light. And we ended up being, have a little bit of a warmer light in the personal quarters, go colder when they are in the control rooms. I tried to have as much practical lighting in there as I could because some of those rooms were so small. The space we worked out in the previous, the design of the ship is very specific, but it's based on science a lot. Mm. So the fragile nature and the you know, almost the cloth with the structure, that comes from, what about 3D printing? What about using lighter materials rather than metal box substances? And that gives the special design, the fragile design. And then also, you know, in space, they never take care about weightlessness, but weightlessness has a big impact. So that's the rotating thing.
Yeah.
But creating gravity, it's not like you already have it or you can build it into a spaceship. It doesn't work like that. It was an organic way to get there. And, you know, then when they end up going to Lake Hazen, all of a sudden the instruments in the Lake Hazen radio, when they talk to each other, that radio room, everything's a bit more, it's more like technology from 10 years ago. So when the film happens, it's very old technology. So we started using more light bulbs and older practicals, and I used little Fresnels there, which I didn't use anywhere else. And so it came organically, quite a lot came from the design. And then in Iceland, it came from the weather because we were shooting in a real ice storm. And that was pretty rough. And you think about what you could do with lighting, and then you go there and you're in the storm and you say, oh, no lights, no lights, please.
And I read that you had made use of LED volumes, LED walls. What was that experience like?
in Babo, every time you look out of a window, or you know, when he's up in the control room trying to talk to somebody, that's LED wards out there. So we had sent a team to Iceland to shoot on our practical location with three 65 mil cameras plates. It was great because, you know, in that Arctic station, it's basically George and Augustine and and Iris. And so for the little girl, it was very nice that she could see what's out there and react to it. And we use it for reflections. And it's the ILM system, which then adjusts to your lens and to your camera movement, so you have the parallax right. I think it's such a great and powerful thing. And for your lighting, it's genius, because if it was green screen, then you would light the green screen and the light would have to be above the green screen, and then to get a good light into the room is not so nice, not so easy, but you know, that way you get a lot of that ambience in there.
It's going to be a huge part of the future. I mean, the advantages over, say, green screen or even a translight are just amazing.
Absolutely. And it's so stunning. And then all the examples we saw, it just needs time and a budget to get it right.
Was there a lot of pre-planning with that?
Yeah, we were basically, after they shot the plates, a lot of the film takes place at night, so they had to create a night sky, which wasn't naturally there, and then find the balance. And you know, but that was pretty easy. Once the wall was in place, I think we had half a day to figure out, you know, what color temperature do we want to shoot, what color temperature should it be. Low light levels were a problem, which we didn't foresee too much, because sometimes then with low light levels you might get into flicker with the LEDs.
Wow.
And we couldn't just up our light level in the station because we had a lot of practicals built in. We had a lot of Astera tubes in those. So we could not just say, oh, let's make it 2 stops brighter.
Right.
So we had to find, sometimes we had to find the balance between that or change the shutter angle on a camera. But no, other than that, it's just brilliant.
Yeah.
We also used something which my gaffer introduced me to mimic the snowstorm, or, you know, when the sun comes out at the end of the snowstorm. You know, the shots when he holds Iris' hand at the end, and and also the pot sequence. We shot that on stage, and we used, we had probably like 120-foot ice snow surface. We put some things to the edges, but we, instead of using green screen or white or black, we shot into a Roscoe screen. It's a it's you use for rear projection, but you put a lot of sky panels behind.
Yeah.
You put layers of sky panels behind. And that way you can basically, I could give my desk operator, my dim operator, a picture and say, I want these colors of the sky.
Wow.
And then we have a gradation for sunrise, or, you know, and then we could mimic that very easily.
Gosh, that was very effective.
That was so effective. And that was something I didn't know, but my gaffer, Julian White, introduced me to that.
Wow.
And it was effective. It was incredibly fast. And post loved it. We didn't use green or blue screen. We used it once or twice to shoot the other. We didn't have that. But that screen was one of the most beautiful and powerful things.
That's amazing. It is incredible with, you know, the difference that LED lights have made, and particularly the RGBW LEDs.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it is incredible, and it's so much faster. It speeds up so many things. And you know, just changing gels on lights, you don't do that very often anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you sometimes do it on big HMI sources, but I don't do that very often anymore.
Yeah. And it's exciting to be able to work at that speed, I think.
Yeah, at that speed and the levels you can shoot at right now, everything looks much more real. Yeah. Mm.
As you kind of, from when you started this to when you finished the film, life started to imitate art a little bit, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. yeah. It's interesting. I was in a panel with Stephen and George and Jim, the visual effects guys. And basically, what Stephen, the editor, said, it's, you know, it's amazing because everybody in the film tries to talk to each other and they try to connect. And that's what we had to do after finishing, because we were, you know, George was in LA with Grant and the editor was in LA. A lot of the post was in London. Some was in Calgary, I think. I was in Berlin, and we all tried to connect. We had video sessions, Zoom sessions. We had approve it. We looked at visual effects on iPads, and Alessandro Desplat said he couldn't conduct an orchestra because he had to, you know, they couldn't be all in a room, and then he had to give them notes from video or phone call. No, it was crazy, but I think it changed a lot.
How on earth did you approach the color grade?
I stayed in touch with the VFX people and with George all through the post, and then I was supposed to go to London pretty early on, but that was delayed by a few months. And then September, October, November, I went a few times to London to look at also visual effects and to tell them, you know, to talk about grading and how you could do this and that. And then they were very nice and open. And then, so I had quite a bit of influence on that.
Were you getting mats from them built into the shots that you could access in the grade?
Yes. We always had mats.
Makes such a difference.
A big difference. But we also, we went a step further, because sometimes when you take mats and you want to go too extreme, you start seeing the mats. So you have to get to a level where you just do fine tuning with the mats. So they were very open and, you know, and we talked about this should be darker here, this should be more that. If the background is darker here, then the face stand out more and you don't have to bring up everything so much.
Yeah.
And they were very, and we worked as a team very nicely together. And then with the grade, then I went to London to sit at Company Three's theater there. I had a Zoom session with Stefan Sonnenfeld, who was in LA, and then George Brand would review in LA, and they would come into a cinema and watch on a screen there. I was in London, and we worked our way through.
And so you were making those decisions in a cinema environment.
What we realized is we did those review sessions on iPads, and sometimes, depending on the reception, it's hard. Also compression, the size. When we, in September or October, we started seeing things. I think September we started looking at certain shots on the big screen. All of a sudden, everything goes like, wow, this is really... Well, that's what we wanted to do a little bit. Everything feels different when you see it on a big screen, the rhythm, the size, the scale. Sometimes when you see it on a small screen, you go, maybe should be fussy or do this. But when you can take it in all, can take it all in, I think it just changes everything.
It is a different experience, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's why we love it. And that's why I still think there will be cinemas because of that.
And I think that's where cinema has value, irrespective of what happens with release dates. There is that experience of being in a darkened room with a big screen that's just a different human experience to seeing it on a TV screen at home.
Yeah, no matter how big the TV screen is.
Which can be great, but it's just different.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Now, this was, as well as being done with a theatrical release in mind, this was also a Netflix production. What did that mean from your point of view?
I don't think there was a big difference for me because they...
They were just the studio.
Yeah, but, you know, they demand, like, technical things. They demand to shoot native 4K, but they never told us, you have to do this or, you know, this is your color palette, this is your lenses, or we never had anything like that. So it was total creative freedom, and it was basically, I think they liked what we were doing. Maybe we would have...
That certainly helps, I guess.
Yeah, but they were very supportive and very good, nice studio.
What about HDR? Did you have to do HDR deliverables?
Yeah.
Were you involved in that part of the process, or did you just focus on the theatrical version and let those other versions be done from there?
What we did on this one, theatrical first.
Yep.
Stefan did an HDR pass, which I watched then. And if you've done your exposures and if you've done your, if your film is in a good shape, it usually looks better in HDR. So I don't think it's I don't shoot different for HDR. I don't, Maybe I'm missing opportunities here, but I don't shoot with HDR in mind very different. I like to, you know, have shadows where I don't see and things where I see and then things where I barely see. So
I think that's one of the ways that HDR often goes wrong is when people go, oh, it's this completely different animal. And really, it's just a better version of what we already have. So the same rules basically apply.
I think so. And you have a little bit more latitude on both ends.
Yeah.
I think you have to be, the one thing you have to be careful is with highlights. I think they sometimes tend to look terrible on HDR, but, you know, we're in great hands with Stefan doing the thing and his company being one of the companies who develop constantly in the highest level new things. So I don't, you know, for me it was felt seamless.
What was your process like working on set? Did you work with a LUT on set and did you have a DIT on set?
I tend to treat it like film. You know, some of it was, you know, because it was so VFX heavy, I didn't want to dictate too much of a look before. Also, some stuff like the Arctic. I think there's cliche looks to the Arctic. It's blue, it's cold, it's this and that. And we stayed away from that. We kept the Arctic pretty natural, actually.
Yeah, which worked beautifully.
Oh, thank you. So that was one thing. And then when we did the space and the other locations, I tried to add color to the light. So you know, the mood comes through the color in the lighting.
So doing more in front of the lens than at the back of the camera.
Always. Yeah. Always a good start, and then you can add to that, We had a very different look on Catch where we had a very strong look from the beginning, but that was a different animal. So
I find with these cameras, in many ways, the more you treat them like film, the more they behave like film.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people get caught up in, oh, it's this different thing, so we've got to treat it differently and overthink everything. And you really don't have to.
No, I think there's a practical reason to that as well, because I don't have the time. I'm not a DP who sits in a tent and looks at monitors and tweaks.
Yeah.
I'm on set and I'm operating a camera usually. I'm there and I also want to be there to talk to actors or see what's happening with actors and the director and how, you know, if there's a problem, if there's this, that, you know, I want to be there.
In the middle of the making of the film.
That's where the camera is. That's where a cameraman should be, I think. But so I don't...
It's a much more satisfying process as well, I think.
I like it. Yeah, I like it.
Versus sitting in a black tent somewhere.
No, I couldn't do that. But I don't know, if you do a film where you have six cameras flying around all the time, maybe you need to do that. But
yeah.
I haven't done those films. So I treated it more, you know, we had a couple of LUTs. We looked at things, but we're not going into too much detail there.
LUTs just getting you in the ballpark and then you work to that.
Yeah.
I think it's a very, very sensible way to work. Many people would look at this on screen and go, well, this is a big film. This is the kind of film where you would have all that extra paraphernalia. And I think it's interesting as an example of being able to go, well, no, we're going to do it this way, even though it is a big film.
I think you have to. I think that's the beauty. If you listen to, I don't know, if you listen to Roger Deakins talk about his films, always sounds very simple. And then you look at them and it's inherited beauty to it. I don't know. I like to work that way. And I grew up with film and I try to, like you say, if you overcomplicate things and if you think of all the possibilities you have, you might get lost in them. And then, you know, your film might be the hottest film now. And in 2 years, it looks like, well, you don't want to.
Simplicity can be the hardest thing to pull off, though. It can take a lot of skill to know what not to do.
Well, that's what I try to tell myself. I don't know. I think it's just natural for me in that sense that I look at it as you are in this environment. You are a centerpiece. You combine the technology side and the craftsmanship with the creativity. And then you have actors in front of you and a director. They need certain things. They want certain things. And you're providing the space, so you don't want to, you know, you don't want to be a dictator. You don't want to. You just want to be a good host, in a sense.
Yeah.
I'm not. I keep forgetting technology.
Which is good.
Yeah, sometimes not, for this one, we did a lot of high-end technology, which I hadn't used before, but it's a tool, so it's nothing more. And I might use that again, and then I need to refresh my memory, but I don't, you know, it's not like, it's not part of me, it's part of the tools kit I use.
Yeah. And technology is great when it makes something possible that wasn't possible before, or it makes something better than it was before, but in its own right, it's not that significant.
No, but it's exciting what we can do these days.
Yeah, yeah.
To the realism it can add. But, you know, at the other end, you see a lot of films which take advantage of all of those, and then you don't care because it doesn't look real anymore. You know, you have people flying around, and you have all these big visual effects films, and you don't, it doesn't touch you. So I think you find that balance where it does.
It's like that, I think, with visual effects and with a lot of technology, a lot of camera technology, and also with lighting, that you can go, okay, well, we're going to make the biggest effects film. It's going to be spectacular. We're going to go after making something that's incredibly beautiful lighting every moment. And yet that rarely hits the mark nearly as much as something where you're going, okay, well, it's whether it's visual effects or the lighting or whatever element, I'm just going to make it serve the story. It's much more likely to end up with something like this, where you've got stunning image after stunning image, but they're all being propelled by the story.
Mm. It has to be. Always has to be, because I don't know, if you have a great story, to be honest, I think if you have a great story, your film can look like shit and it's still...
Yeah.
Gets people, and nothing is worse than a film which loses people. You know, I think you want to get the audience, you want to talk to them, and you want to give them, you know, a journey or an insight or you know, a feeling, evoke a feeling which really touches them.
Mm. A great story with great characters that looks pretty average is still going to get people in. And yet, where the visuals are totally in tune with all of those elements, it does elevate it to a completely different level, doesn't it?
I hope so. that's what we would aim, what I think we should aim for.
And I think that then feeds back into those images, that they resonate on a different level because they're drawing on the story and the character and all of these other elements.
Absolutely. And then only film can do that. Music can do it in parts. Film can do it. And there's no other art form which can do that. And so all that's why I always think it's a team effort. If the visual effects can't do it because we don't take care while we're shooting, then we did a bad job. And then it looks bad. And then it looks fake. And so, you know, you have to be a team player in so many levels. I think that you have to be more than you might have had to 30 years ago, but because it became more complex. But the possibilities are endless.
That collaboration is just such a huge part of the filmmaking process, isn't it?
But with all levels, you know, with costume, with production design, with director, of course, with the actors, with, you know, so many things.
Now, you mentioned that you were operating on this and you love operating, which I totally understand. Were you running a single camera for most of this, or did you run multiple cameras at any time?
Well, when we were in the Arctic, we put two cameras on it all as much as we could. There are certain sequences, you know.
Yeah.
I have a very good Steadicam operator from Denmark, Carsten Jacobsen, who did a lot of V-camera and a lot of Steadicam. There's some beautiful Steadicam work in there. And then there were quite a few small intimate scenes where we just use single camera.
Yeah.
So we did both.
I find there are virtues to having a single camera.
Yeah, I think, you know.
For example, I find that the actors know when they're on. When there's one camera in the room, they know when it's their close-up and they bring it.
You're absolutely right. I think you have I think it focuses the team a little bit more. Because if the team monitors, they go, that's a disadvantage of digital. You know, people look at monitors, sometimes they look at monitors on their phone or on an iPad and they go, oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, this should do it. And you go like, you know, when you were shooting on film, you would look at a monitor and you couldn't quite see it. So you would go, oh, maybe I better check. But same single camera, I think, yes, you get more focus, you get more intimacy, you get less distraction, you get, you know, everything narrows down and then it's nice. Yeah. We used two cameras, you know, when we were in the Arctic, obviously, you know, minimize our actors in those circumstances, have them out in those circumstances. In the beginning, we used it more with Kaylin, with the little girl, because we thought, oh, is, you know, we have limited time and we need to move on. We want to get. But she was so good that we did less further on. So,
wow.
Yes.
Because kids are one of those classic examples of when you kind of expect to need multiple cameras.
Yeah, she was really, really good. And we did it at times. And quite often we just said, no, this is our shot and this is the moment. Yeah.
And what's it like for you working with a director who's in so many of the scenes?
George works, he spent a lot of his career with Grant Hasloff, who's his producing partner. And if George is not sure, Grant is the one who he turns to and asks about performance. And sometimes I would say, maybe we should do a little insert here or something. And he would be, okay, let's do it. So those are the people of reference on set, I would say. For me, it's good. It's sometimes more demanding because you have to make calls and you want to take workload off George.
I guess in a sense, it's an extra pair of eyes that's not there.
Yeah.
Clearly it works though.
I've done it before. I did it with Ewan McGregor on his first film. And I did it with Julie Delpy. I think if the relationship, if there's trust and confidence in who you work with, then I think it's easy. You have to work around certain things because you need to have extra time to show what he can't see while he's in front of camera. But George has such good intuition. He's a visual director and he doesn't shoot that much. You know, he's not overcovering. He's not afraid of taking decisions.
I thought the coverage on the film was superb.
Thank you.
When it's right and it just contributes so much to the experience of the audience on an unconscious level.
I think so. But it's also, it has an impact on your work days because, you know, when you shoot and you cover from every angle, everything it minimizes every shot is less important because you have that one there, you have that one there. It doesn't matter. You don't take decisions. And for a crew, it also makes it, you know, there's less focus on everything. George is like sometimes a scene would be just that one shot and he would call it and then you better get it right then because it's not like you have the other five shots to do it. But it's also nice for the team, for the actors, because you move along. You don't drain in this one moment forever because when he has it, he has it and he knows it and he's so good at knowing that.
I think it takes a lot of confidence to get that balance right.
Yeah, and he would feedback with Stephen then at the end of the day. He would go to the editing room and he would know, maybe we should that scene then a little bit more this way. But it was always good and clear. And that's, I think, where George is a master and even a master when he's in front of and behind the camera. So makes it easier.
The relationship between the cinematographer and the editor is one that's not talked about very much.
It's an interesting one because very often you don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, like on set, you talk or you get feedback, but usually you hear mostly when it's technical issues, when there was a focus wrong or something. But we were constantly going back and especially George was going back and forth, and then he was always having feedback from Stephen. We, you know, we have it, it's all good, or we don't, you know, but it's like, it just confirmed what we were thinking on set. Mm. Their main work starts when we are done, basically. So that's why you get a good intuition, but you don't get much more in early on. We had a good collaboration when we did the previous, because that was all edited by Stephen, and that was basically me feeding in shots. We were running it by George. And we knew that that was how we wanted it.
Yeah. How close was the finished film to that previous?
Those two or three sequences are very close to what we previoused.
And on the sequences outside of those, how much preparation went into the coverage, for example, or how much was that kind of worked out on the day?
It depended a little bit because on the glacier was more planned. We needed that weather for this. We needed to be in this area here and it would take us 3 hours to get there. To do, then have only 2 hours to shoot and then get back off the glacier. So that was a lot more determined by the circumstances
Yeah.
And when we were on studio sets, we quite often had a good idea of the scene, but it was very often it was like, let's rehearse this, let's figure this out, and then let's shoot it. Because after all, those rooms are very, you know, they're not that big.
Yeah.
And my lighting was not that complicated, so it was more easy to move around. And it
could be a more intuitive process, I guess.
Yes.
How did you approach dailies?
No screenings. We had dailies on pics.
Yep.
So everybody could review on pics. And, you know, dailies on digital for me is like, I remember very well what we shot and it doesn't change anymore. So it's not like...
not a big part of the process for you?
Not that much.
Yeah.
On film it was, yes, oh, how did it turn out? What was it? And is this was it in focus? Not in focus, but very on digital, you know all of that. And since you don't sit together and watch it on a big screen, I think it diminishes.
Doesn't mean as much.
No, because you see it compressed on pics or whatever system, whatever online system that is. It's never good quality. So, you know, you rather go to an editing room and you know, we did that a few times. We sat in an editing room, we watched sequences, we decided, oh, this is good, this is not good. But that's so much better because they have better quality.
So that time in the editing room is actually more valuable to you than sifting through all the day's footage?
Yeah. I mean, if you have questions or if you know, you know, or if there's a technical problem popping up, I go through those. Or if I, it's more like an archive.
Yeah,
and, you know, if you have a scene and then 2 months later you shoot another piece, you know, or when we shot Augustine and Iris in a snowstorm, we couldn't finish all of it because of limited daylight, and then also because of having the little girl in the Arctic. So we shot a little bit of that, you know, especially the end when the sun comes through, we shot that on stage. So then you go back and look at that for reference and then to remind yourself what you need to match to. But I don't watch that many dailies.
And I guess, you know, if you're operating and the viewfinder on the Alexa 65 is pretty good and you've got your LUTs and you're working to that, you're basically watching dailies while you're shooting, aren't you?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I shot once a commercial with a director and it was his first commercial digital. And we looked at a monitor and we shot it and he was like, so that's it? The magic is gone? It's not no surprises anymore? And you say, in a way, yes, but it's also faster because you know that it's there and you know it's there as you like it. But I don't know.
You've obviously got fond memories of film. Would you go back if the opportunity presented itself?
I think that... I could do film anytime, but I'm not sure what it would add other than a lot of complications because there's rarely labs anymore. You need, you know, you see your stuff 3 days later or so, then you don't know, you might not be able to reach, you probably wouldn't be able to do what you've missed.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I wouldn't fight for film. If a director wants to shoot really film for something, great. There were a couple of projects where I thought maybe we should shoot 16mm.
Yeah.
You know, 22 would have been nice in 16mm, but that would be even more complicated, I think.
yeah.
And that would make a bigger difference.
I thought Carol pulled that off beautifully.
Carol is a beautiful example. Yeah.
But I think there's very few examples of that working that well.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And what I like about digital is that it's more intuitive with the lighting and you can show more, more naturally. So it's, I think that's a big benefit for me.
Now you still do commercials as well. How do you find balancing commercials and feature work?
It gives me the freedom to wait for a good project.
Yeah.
I don't need to do the next project. I can wait for one which I really like and want to do.
And I guess it also keeps the skills sharp, keeping the skills honed and waiting at the same time.
Yeah, and have a family life, which is nice.
Yeah.
Sometimes you meet people who you then walk, like I met Anton Corbijn on music videos and then we shot Control and we working together.
Martin, thank you so much for your time and congratulations again on the film. It's a really beautiful piece of work. Thanks for stopping in.
Oh, thank you, Ben.